Welcome to the podcast of Sound Medicine, Public Radio's weekly health news magazine. I'm your host, Barbara Lewis. This free podcast is produced by WFYI Indianapolis in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine, and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters. I'm Barbara Lewis. Today, a special edition of Sound Medicine, why so many doctors seem to be miserable and what can be done about it.
People who went into medicine a generation ago went into a very different field than what we have today. Those coming in now, I think, go in with their eyes opened.
Lately, the amount of paperwork or electronic kind of busy work has grown to the point where it's really unsustainable.
We'll have some concrete ideas on how doctors can get back to actually, practicing medicine.
Work that either could be re-engineered out of the practice or could have been done by someone else.
And we'll meet some newly minted physicians who want to prevent burnout before it happens.
I love what I'm doing today and I wouldn't do anything else. And I'm afraid for the people that feel otherwise.
Plus, actual research on how to spend your money so it really does buy happiness.
The problem is people exceedingly discount the value of their memories.
That's all coming up on this special edition of Sound Medicine.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine, and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters.
Welcome to Sound Medicine, Public Radio's weekly magazine about medicine and health. I'm Barbara Lewis. Every week in the Sound Medicine offices, we read a lot of health news while we decide which stories to air on this show. We're interested in issues that affect your health, but we also like to cover doctors' perspectives on medicine. In the past few months, we've noticed a troublesome trend. Doctors seem to be growing more dissatisfied with their daily routines, or at least more vocal. Here's a harrowing statistic for you. At least 300 doctors take their lives annually. That's like an entire medical school graduating class disappearing each year. So what's happening to send so many doctors into despair? Physician and author Danielle Ofri told us that the attitude shift from optimism to disillusionment can begin during training.
Certainly when medical students start medical school, they are brimming with empathy, professionalism, commitment, optimism. We find at the end of training that many of these qualities have taken a beating. I think any doctor you talk to will reflect upon how medicine isn't quite the way it used to be. And no matter how old or young they are, that everyone has an idea of what it used to be like and what it is now. I think that many of the ideals that people come into medicine with, when they get to the reality of medical care, isn't quite the same. The logistics of care, the time crunch, the paperwork, seem to sap away at the reasons that people went into medicine. Doctors who, when are measured for burnout, definitely do have more issues with substance abuse, with behavior that's inappropriate in medicine, alcoholism. Certainly, drug addiction and suicide are higher in the medical profession than they are in comparable professions, something that's very sad. On average, every day a doctor takes their own life.
A common complaint is that medicine today involves too little actual patient care and too much busy work.
Lately, the amount of paperwork or electronic kind of busy work has grown to the point where it's really unsustainable.
That's Iowa physician Christine Sinsky, who has looked into how doctors can find more joy in practicing medicine. You'll hear more from her later. Not all doctors are unhappy on the job, of course. But as some physicians make their complaints public, it's worth listening to them. After all, you want your doctor to be attentive, from your office visit to your worried phone call at 3 a.m. You want the person who's looking for the cause of your symptoms to be thorough, not hasty. And if you're counting on your doctor to find solutions to your problems, you want someone who's feeling creative and resourceful, not bitter and burned out. So on today's Sound Medicine, we're going to look at the issues that are worrying doctors and possibly affecting the quality of care they provide. We'll also offer some surprising advice on how you can find more happiness by changing where you look for it. Dr. Ofri says doctors starting out today may have an advantage. The challenges of modern medicine won't be a surprise.
I think the issue of generation plays a big role. Medicine's changed a lot, and I think people who went into medicine a generation ago went into a very different field than what we have today. Those coming in now, I think, go in with their eyes opened.
Dr. Ofri will also come back later in the show. But first, we'll join some doctors in training as they gird themselves against a specific type of unhappiness facing many doctors, burnout.
And then we asked, what can a small but motivated group of fourth-year medical students do? And we decided to try to convene this conference. A venue.
I'm at a conference at the Sidney and Lois Eskenazi Hospital, a public hospital in Indianapolis, Indiana. It's called Finding Inspiration and Resilience in Medicine, and over 100 medical school students are in attendance. The conference could also be called How to Avoid Burnout. It's unlikely that a conference like this would have been organized and attended by medical school students 20 years ago, but burnout and dissatisfaction among physicians are now being measured and analyzed. The medical school students who organized this conference were reacting to a two-year-old survey of nearly 14,000 physicians. The soul-crushing results? 77% of physicians say they were somewhat or very pessimistic about the future of the medical profession. 60% said they'd retire today if they could.
The statistic that I found most alarming was that more than half of physicians would not recommend that their own children go into medicine. And to me, that was staggering because I would be honored if my daughter went to medicine. I love it so much. And to think that, you know, maybe in 20 years I wouldn't have that joy and I wouldn't feel that same way was really surprising to me.
Hannah Brooks is a fourth-year medical student and a resident in OBGYN.
Our thought with this conference was there are so many big problems with medicine, and as a group of fourth-year med students, we really can't make a dent in that right now. But we can make a dent in everyone's personal attitude and approach to practicing medicine.
Another organizer, Chris Sinsabaugh, is going into radiology. Before he entered medical school, he spent 4 years in the Marine Corps serving as an infantry machine gunner in Iraq.
I've literally had to dig ditches just to avoid, you know, being shot at one point. So today, when I come in, and on the worst day that I can have in healthcare, working as an almost physician, is better than the best day would have been when you're looking, you know, down the barrel of a gun. I love what I'm doing today, and I wouldn't do anything else. And I'm afraid for the people that feel otherwise.
He pointed to another set of sad statistics provided by the Physicians Foundation, the group who did the Survey of American Physicians.
There was this previous study that they had done that looked at how physicians interact with each other. And at that time, 60 to 70% of physicians thought that the best part of their day was getting to interact with their colleagues. And that number dropped to somewhere around 30 to 40%. And I think it's very telling that the attitudes that we bring with us to work can change the way that it is that we interact with the people at work.
So is attitude the best buffer against burnout? The student organizers invited Dr. Lottie Derby as their keynote speaker. She is a professor of medicine and medical education at Mayo Clinic.
When we think about burnout in doctors, we think about things such as work hours and loss of autonomy, loss of meaning, work-home conflict. Those are all big drivers of burnout. Physicians work many more hours than anybody else in other professions, and that's a big driver. And then there's all those factors of medicine. You know, you're dealing with death and dying. You're dealing with very complicated government regulations and paperwork, and just the business of medicine itself has become increasingly complex. You get a lot of meaning as a doctor when you're in a room seeing a patient, you're helping them out, you're talking to their family members. We don't get a lot of meaning out of interacting with the EMR, the insurance companies, or filling out, you know, authorization forms for crutches.
By the way, EMR, or electronic medical records, are always mentioned when I asked what takes the joy out of medicine. So, is our fate as patients appointments with joyless doctors from now on? No, the real impact will be the shortage of doctors.
This is going to be a big issue. Doctors who were burnt out and distressed, they're cutting back on their clinical hours and they're retiring early, or they're changing practices. And all those things cost institutions money and make it difficult for patients to access care. So I think there's a lot of momentum behind trying to make it a more sustainable career.
Everyone here agreed that the solutions will likely be as complex as our current healthcare system. But the goal is simple. Physicians need to spend more time with their patients and less time with their computers. I asked Dr. Derby if she could change one thing to make things better. She said a good start would be in the number of regulations imposed on physicians.
each piece of regulatory requirement, oh, it's just one more form, that's not a big deal, is the perspective. But when you put all of them together, oh, wait, it's 50 more forms or it's 100 more forms. So I think we need to sort of come to a reality check in terms of what are we really expecting physicians to do.
So while we're waiting for that reality check, coping seems to be the best way to pass the time. Dr. Steve Bodgwick, who conducted a session on leadership, was impressed by the medical students' resilience in organizing a conference on resilience.
There's no question that medicine has become more complex, more regulated, more of a business than it has ever been. But it's still a hallowed profession. And what I think these students are doing is they're tapping into the fact that you never want to, nor should you ever lose sight of that. Now, most people would argue, well, medicine is meaningful. It can be drudgery. It just depends on how people think about it, how leaders help people tap into the purpose that they're really there for. So I really applaud the students because they hear a lot. They hear, oh, it's really hard and it's not what it used to be. Well, nothing's like it used to be.
And for student Hannah Brooks, her plan is to hang on to the enthusiasm she feels right now.
I think part of it is remembering every day what a privilege it is to do what we get to do. We get to do amazing things. I come home at night and I can't believe that I just got to operate on someone or deliver a baby. And so I think keeping that in mind, I think also remembering your motivation for why you did it in the first place and coming back to that often and reflecting on that can really help.
I'm Eric Metcalf, and your Sound Medicine stat for the day is 235,000. Last year, doctors in 24 different specialties answered a survey about their job satisfaction. On average, their job satisfaction was this. Meh. Only 51% said they would get into medicine if they could do it all over. Would a little more money change their minds? It doesn't look like it. The highest paid specialty was orthopedics. These doctors made, on average, more than twice as much as the lowest paid specialty, the doctors who treat HIV and other infectious diseases. Specifically, they made $235,000 more. However, orthopedists were third to lowest in overall satisfaction. The much more poorly paid infectious disease doctors had the second highest overall satisfaction. One of the parts of the job that doctors found most rewarding was the relationship with the patient. So if you want to bring some joy to your doctor's life, a sincere thank you may work better than leaving a tip. That was your Sound Medicine stat, and I'm Eric Metcalf.
Coming up on Sound Medicine, how working at the top of their license may lift doctors' morale.
Even at the best of practices, we're all struggling with something, but we found reasons for hope.
And later, the relationship at the center of the practice of medicine that still inspires so many physicians.
Despite all the pressures and annoyances, nearly every doctor still loves the part of medicine that is really the heart of medicine, the connection with the patient.
You're listening to Sound Medicine. Welcome back to Sound Medicine. I'm Barbara Lewis. Let's check in with Jill Dittmeyer now for this week's health news headlines.
Thanks, Barb. The surgeon who became famous on Oprah had a less supportive audience this week. Mehmet Oz, Dr. Oz to most of us, thought he was being asked by a Senate committee to help root out fraud in the medical supplement and diet pill business. But instead, he was called on the carpet for the ads that make it look like he is endorsing weight loss gimmicks such as green coffee beans. Dr. Oz said he was perplexed by the ads and the hearing, since he hadn't meant actually to endorse the supplements. But when we looked online midweek, we could still find pop-up ads at major websites promoting weight loss gimmicks with the slogan, endorsed by Dr. Oz. It's probably not too surprising that long-term unemployment is bad for your health as well as your bank account. A Gallup poll released this week found that people unemployed for a year or more are significantly more likely to be obese than folks who are out of work for a shorter time. Some new numbers this week from the group of young people who were allowed to stay on their parents' health insurance until they were 26 years old. The AMA published a study that surveyed about 26,000 young adults. Compared with the same age group a decade ago, 6% more people in this survey reported being in excellent physical health, 4% more said their mental health was excellent, and there was a significant drop in how much they were paying for health care out of pocket. Finally, is ignorance really bliss? A large study out of Norway this week suggests that people who don't know they have health problems tend to rate their own health as good. But when they find out that they do have issues, such as high blood pressure or prediabetes, their sense of well-being drops. Researchers noted that with so many more screening tests available now, there is also a risk of overdiagnosis. So they said we should be asking our doctor whether health screening will do any good or improve our chances of living longer. Reporting for Sound Medicine, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
Health news headlines are presented in part by the Marion University College of Osteopathic Medicine in Indianapolis.
After college, future doctors spend at least another 7 years in medical school, in residency, and sometimes a fellowship. They learn skills that few others know, like how to do procedures, recognize the symptoms of rare diseases, and make life-changing decisions quickly. But for hours every day, many doctors handle chores that don't require these high-level skills. Instead, they're filling out one paper form after another. They're clicking boxes on yet another electronic medical record. Our next guest, internist Christine Sinsky, joined us to talk about how doctors can find more time for the tasks that their patients really need, healing. Dr. Sinsky, welcome to Sound Medicine.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
When we think of the traditional duties of a primary care doctor, we picture you listening to our hearts through a stethoscope, making a diagnosis, writing a prescription for us. You're concerned that doctors are spending too much of their time doing other things. What new duties have doctors picked up?
Well, that's a really great question, and I am concerned that we are spending much of our time doing things that aren't of highest value to our patients. Over the last 10 years, there's been an increased number of additional tasks that have been placed to the physician, work that might previously have been done by other members of the team, say the receptionist or a medical records clerk or a pharmacist, have been pushed to the physician, in large part as a consequence of implementation of electronic health records.
So tell us a little bit about the study you did. You went to look to see what physicians were spending their time on. And you found some alarming, I think, statistics of how much time they're not spending with us.
Sure. So we did this wonderful study called In Search of Joy in Practice, and we visited 23 high-functioning practices across the country. So really the exemplars, the best of the best, if you will. And even in those places, we observed that probably on the order of 70 to 80% of the physician work output was work that either could be re-engineered out of the practice or that was low value, that was waste, or could have been done by someone else with different technology or different policies.
I think for patients, we thought that electronic medical records would make our health care better by really informing all the doctors that we see and kind of improving our care. It sounds like it's making physicians have some headaches, but is it still better for the patient?
I think in our civilian lives, if you will, technology has been such a win that we would assume that it would be that much of a benefit in all arenas. And I think it will eventually be a big win in healthcare, but we're going through this time of transition, and it's probably going to be a 10 to 20 year transition, which I think is unexpected. And the EHR, the electronic health record, I think has been both a blessing for patient care and a burden. So it's not been all bad or all good.
What have those top practicing physicians done about electronic medical records that has made them able to practice and feel better about their practice?
Well, one of the things that many of the practices did is that they recognized that it does take a team of people to deliver the best care for patients and that we need to share some of the work with some of the team members. So one practice, for example, in Minneapolis had the medical assistants and the nurses given permission to take work off the doctor's inbox, this long list of tasks to be done. Many physicians have 300 inbox messages waiting for them every day, signatures to be put on a prescription or a lab result that was normal to be checked off. And at Fairview, they've allowed their nurses and medical assistants to share a lot of that work so that only those small minority of messages that need to get passed on to the physician go to the physician's work list. So that's one example. And there's another that I'd like to tell you about. And that would be in several of the practices, instead of it being just the physician who is in charge of record keeping, the physician and a clinical assistant, either a nurse or a medical assistant, take care of the patient together in the room. And while the doctor is interacting with the patient, the assistant is recording much of the work and operationalizing things like putting in the orders or sending the prescriptions so that the physician can really devote her full attention to the patient.
Kind of a scribe, if you will, I think is the term that people are using now.
I think that doesn't really capture the full benefit that that person can add. So it's a term I tend to shy away from. Even at the best of practices, we're all struggling with something. But we found reasons for hope. We found models of care with a lot of pre-visit planning, with sharing the care among the team, with finding ways to deal with the electronic health record that are good for the patient and good for the physician. And it was really awe-inspiring to be part of that work.
And is joy the appropriate word? I'm just thinking of, you know, so many primary care physicians just feel overburdened that even in the best, most high-functioning practices, I'm not sure I would choose the word joy, but you have.
We have, and, you know, I am glad that we did because I have seen this now being picked up and used by many people. The American College of Physicians, for example, which is the largest physician professional organization representing internists and subspecialists, has chosen improving joy in practice as one of its core strategic plans going forward. I think that that term is resonating with physicians across the country, so I'm glad we chose it.
Let's talk about another term that I think resonates with physicians, but I think as patients we don't quite understand, and that's that you recently wrote that doctors should spend more time working at the top of their license. What does that mean?
So physicians train for 11 years, and that's a lot of time that individual people as well as society has invested in that training. And I think we need to be mindful of fully leveraging that training and not spending most of those professionals' time doing work that either doesn't need to be done or someone else could do it. There's always been a little bit of paperwork, but lately the amount of paperwork or electronic kind of busy work has grown to the point where it's really unsustainable. And it's taking physicians away from doing what patients need us to do. And that's to really listen to them.
I'm talking with Dr. Christine Sinsky. She is a general internist in Dubuque, Iowa, and one of her areas of focus is helping physicians find more enjoyment in their work, which may help them provide better health care to their patients. And that's exactly my question. Do you see these reforms and new methods of trying to get back to patient care really improving patient health?
I do. And there's some developing evidence of that. For example, one of our study sites in the Boston area has been able to substantially reduce the number of hospital admissions and the number of emergency room visits because of this wraparound kind of care that they've been able to provide. And I think we know that when physicians are burned out, we make more mistakes, our patients are less adherent to our treatment, we don't show as much empathy. They're less satisfied with our care. So if we can address that physician burnout issue, we'll have a safer, less costly, more effective healthcare system.
And what can patients do to help their doctors squeeze the most value out of an office visit?
That's a great question. Let's think. So what can patients do? I think patients have a right to have their physician's full attention. And I think when patients aren't getting our full attention because we're multitasking, it's okay to pause and just wait for that eye contact. I think patients can come to their visits prepared, kind of think about what are your health goals, what are your goals for today. The more activated patients are, I think the better the care. So if a patient knows their medications, is interested in learning how they can be in charge of their own care, how they can exercise more, eat in a healthy way, that goes a long way toward improving their care.
Well, Dr. Christine Sinsky, thank you so much for talking with me on Sound Medicine.
Barbara, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Christine Sinsky is a general internist at the Medical Associates Clinic in Dubuque, Iowa. If you have any thoughts on this topic or a comment on anything you've heard on our show, we'd love for you to share them with us. You can post on our Facebook page, you can send us a tweet, or click on the Contact Us button at soundmedicine.org. We know that car airbags can help protect heads and chests during a crash. Now a study says the device can save our kidneys as well. Sound Medicine Jill Dittmeyer has more in this week's checkup.
It's the leading cause of death from unintentional injury for people of all ages. And it's a tremendous burden on public health with overall costs of more than $70 billion per year.
That's Dr. Mark Bierlin talking about the number of people killed in motor vehicle accidents. During his residency, he saw those statistics. Now, as a clinical instructor of urologic oncology at New York University, he wants to help lower them.
As a urologist, I'm interested in kidney trauma, and as a result, we focused specifically on the role of airbags and seatbelts in protecting occupants from kidney injury and then subsequent removal of the kidney called nephrectomy.
In his study, Bierlin used the National Trauma Database from 2010 to 2012 to find people who suffered renal injuries in a motor vehicle crash.
But we searched about 2.4 million patient records, which gave us those.
Then he looked at numbers to see how many were wearing a seatbelt and had an airbag deployed during the crash.
About 3,846 occupants sustained a kidney injury. Specifically, we found that occupants who were wearing seatbelts had a statistically lower rate of kidney injury, and those occupants who had both a seatbelt and an airbag had the greatest decrease in high-grade kidney injury.
In fact, those wearing a seatbelt were 24% less likely to injure a kidney. Add the airbag, and those positive percentages doubled.
This is a study that no one's done before, but it's probably very predictable. If you remain restrained and you're not bouncing within the cabin of the car or ejected from the car, you'll definitely have decreased rates of injury.
Bierlin says the new study confirms an established safety message.
Buckle up, and if you have an airbag, or if you can purchase a car with an airbag, it'll provide additional protection.
Reporting for Sound Medicine, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
He said that it was from when the cause had smashed his soul.
If you're one of the Sound Medicine podcast subscribers, you may have noticed that we've made a few changes recently in how we distribute each week's show. To subscribe or to resubscribe, just go to soundmedicine.org and click the box in the upper right-hand corner. And welcome back.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters.
Welcome back to Sound Medicine. I'm Barbara Lewis. Today, we're talking about happiness and why both doctors and patients may be finding it in short supply. Our next guest is Dr. Daniel Ofri, a physician in New York whose most recent book about the practice of healthcare is called What Doctors Feel. Doctors in training may have trouble hanging on to their enthusiasm and idealism once they move out of the classroom, she says.
Well, certainly when medical students start medical school, they are brimming with empathy, professionalism, commitment, optimism. And when we study these traits, we find at the end of training that many of these qualities have taken a beating. And it seems to happen mostly during the transition from the classroom years to the clinical years. something that seems counterintuitive. This should be the flowering, one would think, of empathy and doctor-patient connection. But I think there are a number of reasons for that. One is that medical students, when they come into the real world of medicine, it's much more chaotic and unpredictable than classroom life, and they feel often very lost, useless, and they're constantly being shifted to new places, new teams, and never have a chance to develop stable relationships with patients or mentors. But even more so than that is what we call the hidden curriculum. There's the explicit curriculum. They learn about the ideals of medicine, empathy, compassion, but then they watch how medicine is actually practiced, and I think they see that many of these important qualities are dispensed with when it comes to the actualities of patient care. And they'll observe senior doctors being disrespectful with patients, talking to nurses in a way that doesn't communicate empathy and compassion, making jokes behind people's backs about patients or other staff. And they say, oh, this is the way people really are doctors. And that contributes to a corroding of some of the ideals that students came in with.
Not only do they face the new realities of a doctor's life, like filling out all those forms, but some more entrenched challenges.
Patients are very medically complicated. People have many chronic illnesses, acute illnesses. There are overlays of socioeconomic issues. People have been laid off from work. There's a lot of psychological components, prior approvals needed from insurance, and yet the same 15 minutes to handle all this. And you either have to cut corners, or you can't do a good job, and you don't feel right either way. You don't want to cut corners. You want to document appropriately and thoroughly. On the other hand, you want to spend your time talking with the patient, examining them. But then if you take too long, then the next patient has to wait, and patient satisfaction goes down, your productivity numbers go down. So it seems like you can't win.
Burnout doesn't have just consequences for the doctor. It may be harmful for the person on the other side of the stethoscope, too.
In order to be empathic, you have to be able to imagine how someone else is feeling. Put yourself in their shoes and convey them. It requires being settled in your own shoes. It's very hard to focus on someone else's issues if your own issues are dominating. So I think doctors who are burned out and disillusioned have a much harder time stepping out of their shoes to be empathic. And where this comes into play is we've actually studied empathy and seeing that patients of doctors who score higher on various empathy scales, these patients have better clinical outcomes with their diabetes, for example, with their cholesterol, depression, even the common cold seems to be shorter in patients whose doctors score better on the empathy scale. So you can imagine that doctors who are very disillusioned and burned out probably do worse in the empathy department. So I imagine their patients likely do worse, though we don't have hard data for this part.
Dr. Ofri is hopeful that the next generation of doctors will be able to tap into more sources of resilience as they go into their careers.
In a recent large survey of doctors, it seemed that, interestingly, the younger doctors, the female doctors, the doctors in primary care, seem to be the least disillusioned. And I think the issue of generation plays a big role. Medicine's changed a lot, and I think people who went into medicine a generation ago went into a very different field than what we have today. Those coming in now, I think, go in with their eyes opened. So for people who had a different image of medicine, they're not going into medicine now. So maybe for the younger generation is less surprised, not to say that medicine now is better or worse than it was, but it is different. And the stereotype of, doctors going into medicine just for the money, I think that's largely gone. All those folks went off to Wall Street. So who's coming into medicine now? People who really want to be there, and that's including a broader group. Women, minorities, people from underrepresented communities are now coming into medicine. And for many of these communities of people, they're striving very hard to be there, and thus they're more satisfied once they get there. Most doctors, certainly young medical students, have the good fortune of being healthy, and we never really experience what it's like to be ill. And certainly having a baby isn't being ill, but it is an experience of being vulnerable, dependent, not able to do many things for yourself. And I learned a lot. I remember from my first child, which I gave birth to in my own hospital, small things were so important as a patient. I remember after the delivery, they bring you up to your room and give you that frosty pitcher of water. that you've been waiting for all day. And for me, the pitcher was just out of reach, and I couldn't just jump up and grab it. And I tried to lasso it with a pillow, and I tried to pull the table over, and I couldn't get that water. And I remember that at that moment, that pitcher of water was the most important thing in the universe. I didn't care who was dying in the next ward over. I wanted that water. And so I called for help, and they said they'd come. But, of course, nobody came. And I know as a doctor there are many sicker patients on the ward that need more attention than my cup of water. But I didn't care as a patient. And I kept calling and calling. And, when it finally came, I realized this is the most important thing for me. And now when I see my patients, I know that their actual medical care, they're getting better, is clearly the most important thing. But when they need a ginger ale or the box of tissues at that instant, that's the most important thing. And if I can just take one extra minute to attend to that, I think the patient then feels like they're being taken care of. They're not being ignored or shunted to the side. So I really learned about those seemingly small things take on a great importance when you are ill and vulnerable.
If doctors can look past the electronic medical records, their encounters with patients can still provide much-needed job satisfaction.
Despite all the pressures and annoyances, nearly every doctor still loves the part of medicine that is really the heart of medicine, the connection with the patient. And I feel very optimistic that we've managed to preserve that in its centrality and importance. Most of the frustration of medicine is, the surrounding parts, the accoutrements, not the essence of medicine itself. I mean, there are probably a few who are frustrated with that part, and largely those people eventually drift away from clinical care. So I'm very optimistic, especially with our newer generations of doctors, that they're in it for the right reasons.
Dr. Danielle Ofri practices at Bellevue Hospital in New York. You can find more of her thoughts on medicine at her website. We'll post a link on our website at soundmedicine.org. And finally this week, enough about doctors. How are you doing? If you're feeling burned out and unfulfilled, new research in the field of happiness might offer you a solution. Our next guest, Ryan Howell, is an associate professor at San Francisco State University. He recently published a paper that declared that buying so-called life experiences makes Americans happier than buying material goods such as cars, even though many of us think the opposite is true. In other words, at the end of our lives, are we better off having great stuff or great memories? Before we start talking about purchasing experiences versus things and happiness, could you define your version of happiness?
Well, I think if you think a little bit about the good life, you get a pretty good understanding of what we mean by happiness. And often, I think people have a tendency to sort of disparage happiness a little bit because they think of it as just sort of this fleeting positive emotion that, we sort of only feel so often. But happiness is a lot more than that. It's about having good relationships with your friends and your family, strong connections at work, having purpose in your life. So it's a concept that we talk about is eudaimonic well-being, but unfortunately that's not a term that's usually written about in the New York Times.
That phrase Ryan Howell just used again is eudaimonic. It dates back to Aristotle, and it defines happiness as a blend of pleasure, prosperity, wisdom, and virtue. Okay, now, back to Dr. Howell.
So I think happiness is really sort of all the things that make our life worth living. And that's sort of the best definition we have of it.
So how do you think our wealth and how we spend it actually affects our happiness?
Well, I think if you look at most of the research out there, Maslow was on to something when he started talking about the hierarchy of needs. And by that, what we mean is there is good evidence that when you're in poverty, you're likely going to be spending your money on physical needs, and therefore your money buys you happiness. But Maslow also suggested that if there's a deficiency in your psychological needs, then when you are spending your time and efforts in reducing those deficiencies, that'll also make you happy. And so most of what our research shows is that when people have more discretionary income, then they can make themselves happier by spending their time and their money on bringing themselves closer to their friends and family, by filling the need of competence so they feel like they're sort of mastering something, and ensuring that they're expressing their identity, sort of their values, who they truly are. And that's one of the reasons why experiential purchases make us happier than material items.
Yeah, so let's talk about your new study. You conducted several experiments that led you to conclude that spending our money on life experiences can make us happier than buying material goods. So tell us a little bit about how you conducted your study.
Well, there's several studies in there, and this particular study or series of studies is really sets of forecasting studies. So, you know, Leif Van Boven is sort of the godfather of our field, right? In 2003, he was the first one to sort of empirically demonstrate that life experiences make us happier than material items. And since then, there's been a whole host of other researchers who have verified that across lots of different dimensions and lots of different groups. And what we tend to see is that universally, when people spend their money on life experiences, they're happier than when they spend their money on material items. Something that had bothered me and my lab was that this information has been out for a long period of time, and there was sort of a craze of this in sort of the late sort of 2009 time when there was a lot of research that was being done on this, and yet there's no evidence, at least in our database, that people were becoming more experiential. So we asked the question, why not? And what we found was, and quite simply, people are probably making a forecasting error. So while they're actually really good at forecasting or predicting that their life experiences will make them happier, they believe that their material items will actually provide them a sense that their money was well spent. And that's because material items are tangible and reusable. The problem is people exceedingly discount the value of their memories. And so what they end up thinking is that life experiences will make them happier, but material items will provide them more value. And so when they're value-seeking, they go towards material items. The problem is, in reflection, that doesn't tend to be the case. It tends to be that your life experiences also make you happier and also make you feel like your money was better spent.
And Dr. Howell, if you watch a half hour of commercial television, you watch the commercials, I mean, I feel like that's what they're selling us. I mean, it's not really the car. It's the, you know, the kind of the whole story that goes along with that 60-second or 30-second spot that we're really kind of buying, aren't we, or wanting?
Well, and sure. I mean, when you think about material items, and marketers are really good at this, they sort of lure us in with this focusing illusion, and that's this sort of 15 to 30 seconds of sort of the ideal situation. So you're driving your convertible along the coast, and the highway is beautiful, and the wind's blowing through your hair. There's no smog, and there's no traffic, and there's no annoying person on the radio. And so they are trying to sort of sell you that materials can provide experiences. The problem is a couple of things. One, materials degrade over time. So they need to be replaced as opposed to our memories, which don't need to be replaced. They tend to get worse, and they have a whole host of sort of necessary requirements. For one, you have to use them. So if you buy a material item and never use it, then you never gain any enjoyment from it, whereas it's exceedingly rare that you buy a life experience and don't actually enjoy the experience. You have to think of a situation where you maybe like buy tickets to a concert and then didn't go. And the vast majority of time when we buy experiences, we actually utilize them. So this is sort of what, you know, marketers in some ways get right, that, you know, these products may provide us these experiences, but it's not as easy as the commercial makes it seem.
Are there people, though, because you have a lot of quizzes on the beyondthepurchase.org website, and there's a lot of tests that people can take. Are there people, though, that are really just happy with material goods? I'm thinking if somebody is really naturally an introvert and really does
I was really materialistic, that maybe they would be happier. But are you saying that all of us are just really happier with life experiences, spending our money on that versus something?
Well, no. It's interesting that you mentioned that. I think the press release in the article that sort of led to the interview was on one paper, but we just had a paper that was published in another journal that sort of tried to address this question, so I can speak to that as well. About a third of people are so materialistic that they derive little to no enjoyment out of their life experiences. And the problem is they also derive little to no enjoyment out of their material items. And that seemed counterintuitive to us in the beginning. We thought, well, you know, really materialistic people must like their material items, but they don't. And the problem is there's sort of this double-edged sword that they're sort of dealing with. If they buy life experiences, what appears to be happening is that they're buying life experiences to try and impress other people, and therefore it's really inauthentic to who they are. And any time you put your happiness into the hands of other individuals, what you find is that they sort of fail to deliver and you don't end up being very happy.
Let's talk a little bit about the types of life experiences. Because
Sure.
Like when you were talking about the materialistic people, I was just thinking
Sure.
about a recent article about climbing Mount Everest, you know,
Yeah.
paying a lot of money to get up to the summit so you can come back and tell all your friends you've made it to the summit. But you're
Right.
really talking about specific life experiences, not just a trip around the world.
Well, I mean, sure, a life experience can be anything from a cup of coffee with a friend, I met a person recently who actually took off an entire year and traveled across the entire globe and visited 20 different countries. Those are both life experiences. They just, you know, differ in cost and time. Most of the research shows, though, if you look at sort of daily life experiences, they make you quite happy. And sort of dollar for dollar, actually better value than really expensive life experiences. Not to say that you shouldn't, you know, take the wonderful trip up to Everest, because that's a memory that can never be replaced. But when we're talking about life experiences, we're not necessarily trying to describe, you know, someone who needs to save up $10,000. You know, Liz Dunn and her colleagues have shown that when people spend just $5 with their friends, they get these wonderful boosts of happiness. And most of those are literally, you know, coffee shops, diners, small picnics, sandwich with a friend, you know, a lot of food in those situations. But, you know, going to the movies, going to a baseball game and sitting in the cheap seats, shoot, out here in San Francisco, if you're willing to stand, you can stand out and watch, you know, three innings of baseball for free. And if you did it with your friends, that would qualify as a life experience that would make you happy, and it'd be pretty inexpensive. Other data that I have that I find really interesting shows that when you ask people about their happiness in their life and sort of the satisfaction they're getting out of their relationships, that those two constructs are so strongly tied together that it's almost impossible to separate the two. It's almost if you don't have one, you don't have the other. And given this sort of natural social benefit that comes from life experiences, it's not too surprising that that's the major mechanism that makes us happy.
Well, you run a website called beyondthepurchase.org, and you mm-hmm. offer quizzes and tools to help people assess their thoughts and happiness, about happiness and money. Is it mm-hmm. possible for us to change our buying behaviors in a way that leads to more happiness?
Right. I think what is really exciting about most of our research is that if you look at numerous studies that have come before, you know, in the last 20 or so years, they focus on things that are very difficult to change, like our personality traits and our value systems, that once they're set, they're sort of just manifested in different ways. So you mentioned the introvert, who may not really want to be as social as the extrovert. But what you find is that the introvert probably isn't a person who's sort of a hermit or doesn't want to be around anyone, but they're probably more likely to want to be with small groups of individuals, and that's fine. You can still do, you can have a very nice social activity with just one other individual. And so what, you know, most of our research shows, or much of our, you know, modeling shows, is that while your personalities and values are very difficult to change, your buying behaviors, when you put conscious effort towards it, are things that are much easier to change. Not easy to change, but they're definitely easier. And then you can experience the sort of well-being benefits that come from that.
Well, Dr. Ryan Howell, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for talking with me on Sound Medicine. And we'll go check out the quizzes on beyondthepurchase.org.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Ryan Howell is the director of the Personality and Well-Being Lab at San Francisco State University. He runs a website that offers quizzes for you to measure your attitudes about material items and your happiness. We'll provide a link at soundmedicine.org.
Loneliness is nothing new. I've lived with it my whole life through. So look out, gloom. I'm making room for happy. Here we go, here we go, up to where our minds are free, and every day's philosophy says life is wild, be like a child, called a happy, happy. Blues be gone, turning on with happy, happy.
And that's it for this week's program. You can post comments about today's program on Facebook and submit questions that we might answer on future shows. And we're always on at soundmedicine.org. We have to say goodbye this week to Sydney Willman, who has been the Sound Medicine intern, the podcast poster, tweeter, social media queen, and all-around great asset to this show. She's just graduated from IU with a degree in journalism, and she is about to begin a wonderful new job. We wish her well. From here on, Jen Burnham will be handling our social media, so please send her a tweet of welcome. Eric Metcalf prepares our interviews. Chris Lieber records and edits the program. Andy chooses our music. Steve Ali of Jazzville Studios wrote our theme music. Our senior producer is Nora Hyatt. Our executive producer is Eric Eggleton. Sound Medicine is a copyrighted 2014 production of the Indiana University Trustees and WFYI, Metropolitan Indianapolis Public Broadcasting Incorporated. All rights reserved. I'm Barbara Lewis, wishing you good health.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters.
Thanks for listening. For more information about anything you heard on this podcast, please go to our website, soundmedicine.org. I'm Barbara Lewis, wishing you good health.